If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Health facility that turned her away because she's over-medicated. Fuck you.
Could, with the information she provided them. And that wasn't always accurate information. That wasn't always the full picture. And they were doing the best they could with her level of...
Oh, they were doing the best they could. Oh, the poor medical providers.
You know from the records and from the pill bottles what she was prescribed and how she was supposed to take those medications. And you know from the pill bottles what she actually took. And sometimes those two things didn't align with what she told her providers, what she told Patrick, what she told her mother. You take the Zoloft, for example. The prescription was for one 25 milligram pill a day for 7 days, and then to go up to the 50 milligrams after 7 days. She told Dr. Cuss that she took the pills for as prescribed for 7 days, went up on the 8th day to 50 milligrams, and that's when she had the insomnia and the other side effects and symptoms. She told Patrick that she took the pills for 7 days and they had no effect, so she called Dr. Tufts, who then told her to increase the dose. Well, you know what she told Patrick is not accurate because the pill bottle says, take it for a week and then increase it. That was the plan from the beginning. That wasn't the result of a phone call to Dr. Tufts. And you know what she told Dr. Tufts isn't accurate either because only 7 pills were taken from the bottle.
Oh my God. Leaves
you two options. Either she took the medication as prescribed, 1 pill a day for 7 days, and then didn't increase it, which she says is what caused the side effects and the insomnia, or what she did was not keep it as prescribed. She didn't do it 7 days and ease into it and then increase it. She either missed a dose or increased it early before she was supposed to. Either scenario is not good. She knows as a nurse the importance of following the instructions of your medications.
She was going through a mental health crisis.
Do what your provider tells
you. Fucking kidding me. So you're going with the line that because she was a nurse, she should have been a better reporter. She's a nurse who was struggling with a mental... Okay, I'm sorry, guys. I don't mean to keep stopping.
Information to your provider. She didn't say, I went up a dose, went up to 50 too early. Maybe they could have adjusted that and tried the 25 milligram for longer and eased her into it. But no, she told her that she did what she was told and then went up and had these problems. So you can see that in a lot of the medications she has. You have the pill bottles that were turned in by Patrick, and a lot of them don't even have many pills missing from the bottles. Some of them have none. The Buspar prescription, the first one, there's only 2 pills missing. The second prescription, no pills missing. The Lamictal, she never took those pills at all until the night she tried to kill herself. So there's a lack of compliance there, a lack of follow through, a lack of communication with her providers about what was happening with her and how she was taking the medications. And defense wants you to believe that this is a woman who's begging for help and willing to do anything and everything her providers tell her to do to get better.
She was
asking for help. She was. She wanted help. She wanted to get better. She wanted to get better on her own terms, doing things her way.
Bullshit.
She thought she should do them.
No, bullshit. She didn't want to have the side effects of all this cocktail of drugs. She was on 12 to 13 different kinds of drugs, and she was suffering, and she wasn't sleeping, and she wasn't eating, and she was having racing thoughts, and she was hearing voices, and she wanted to hurt herself, and she wanted to hurt her children, and she knew that was all wrong, so she wanted to get the drugs right. Fuck, this is such bullshit.
She knew that's not the right way to approach it. She knew that an accurate medical history, accurate information about your side effects and symptoms, what your thoughts are, that's important for your providers to know. And she didn't do it. And it seems that the reason that she's not necessarily fully compliant and she's doing what she wants to do is she has this desire
Same
to
Melanie.
Be herself again. She just wants to go back to who she was. And she wants it now. And she doesn't want any side effects. She just wants to be herself again.
Any side effects.
That's understandable. That's relatable. To want to get that magic pill that will fix you immediately and you can go back to being yourself. But she knew that's not how it worked. And you know that's what she was thinking because in the searches on her phone, she's searching for things like which antidepressant works the fastest. How fast does Wellbutrin work? And she's searching all of these different medications for the side effects and symptoms, some of them that she never even discusses with her doctors.
So,
and, you know, again, it's relatable that she wants to get back to where she was, but she had discussions with her providers about how these medications work and that it takes time for them to get into your system. It takes time for them to work. She even texted her mother about that, about how she knew that she had to be patient, that it took weeks for the amitriptyline, for example, to get into her system and worked. And she knew all of this, and she couldn't be patient. She couldn't wait. She wanted faster. She even told Dr. Tufts, it's a note in the records, that she knew the problem was that she wasn't focusing on one provider and following one plan. She knew that going from doctor to doctor, practice to practice, South Shore to MGH, the different programs.
She wasn't well.
To deal with the situation. She said it in her own words to Dr. Tuff. You need to stick with one provider and stick with one plan to see if it works.
And you know what Dr. Tuff should have done in that situation? She should have had a conversation with Lindsay and talked to her and said, okay, I think we're getting a little bit, the anxiety is taking over. That's why you're talking to so many people and you're going to this program and you're talking to this person and you're trying, you know, you're getting drugs from this person. And that should have been a sign from her psychiatrist and her psychologists that there was a problem and they didn't address it because they didn't bother to get the records from anybody else. They all thought, oh, I'll just throw these drugs at her and, you know, eventually it'll work. God, these people are awful.
And she actually turned down help from at least two locations at various points. We talked a lot about the women and infants records. And, you know, you don't have to believe what I say about them or the witnesses say about them or defense. You can look at the records themselves. Page 9, it tells them, it says right there, Patrick was the one who said over-medication was the issue. Not the doctors there, not the people evaluating her. What they put was depression, RO, rule out adverse medication effects. That means they have to look into it to see if medication's a problem. But there's a difference between an adverse effect, a symptom, or a problem with a medication and being over-medicated, taking too much of a medication.
I mean, to me, it sounds like she is a defense attorney for all of the prescribers and providers who have been named in the civil suit. That's what it sounds like to me. It's almost like, you know, in John O'Keefe's case, when the prosecution turned into a defense for the McAlberts. This is crazy.
Medication, which is taking, you know, too many at one time. There's a difference there. And Women and Infants never said she was over-medicated. What they also don't do is turn her away. It's not that she went there and they said, can't help you, go away. They told her, it's in the records, based on the onset of her symptoms, they weren't sure if it was postpartum or peripartum. They saw she had an issue. They wanted to help her. It says there, we offered her. They offered her three programs. They offered her the inpatient medical management program. They offered her a partial hospitalization program for general mental health. And they offered her an outpatient program. And she also put a lot of thought into that, into offering her this care. When they gave her three separate options, considering she's a young mom, maybe she doesn't want to be away from home, but we'll give her the option of being in the hospital and getting her medications right. But we'll also give her the option of the partial hospitalization where she can, you know, be here during the day and go home to her kids in the evening. And then that third option of being an outpatient and being able to be at home with her kids and come in for appointments. It was very thoughtful of them. It was very well planned out to give her these three options. And it's kind of the exact opposite of just turning someone away and saying, go away, we can't help you. And her response, I'm going to talk to my provider about it for guidance.
And okay.
She goes to Dr. Tufts.
What she's supposed to do.
At some point. You look at the records. She never discussed those options with them. She told them that Women and Infants turned her away and said she didn't qualify for the program. She didn't discuss those three programs that they offered her. So basically, they give this offer of help, three different forms of help, and she's just, no, doesn't want to do them and doesn't discuss them with her provider. And also that first time she goes to Mass General, to the emergency room, they offer her a bed at McLean, and she turns it down. She wants help. No one's saying she doesn't want help, but she's making these decisions and doing these things that aren't helping her get help, that are turning away help.
Oh, my God.
Because she wants the help in a certain way.
This is so disingenuous. This is not what we heard in this trial.
You know, all during this time, between September and December of 2022, she's interacting with friends, with family, teachers, gym staff, the nanny, people at gymnastics.
That's what people do.
In public spaces, in public ways, driving her kids around, all throughout that time, able to know the difference between right and wrong, able to conform her behavior to the law and to the requirements of society and interacting.
It was a psychotic break. Like it, boom, happened. It doesn't matter if she's able to be a quote unquote normal human being going through and talking to doctors and being able to drive a car. It got to the point where she actually couldn't drive. She had to have her mom drive her. You guys remember that? Like she was telling people, she was worried that people could hear her thoughts. This is not, she's just masking. Oh, you guys all know this.
Presenting herself as a functioning adult, a functioning mom. You know that she knew the difference between right and wrong during that time because she had those thoughts at the beginning of December of harming her kids. And she told Patrick and her mother about them. But who she didn't tell is important and very telling. She didn't tell a single provider, not Tufts, not Gelada, not Jennifer McAllister, not Dukes, no one at McLean, no one at MGH, no one at South Shore, didn't tell any of them. And why? Because the police might take away her kids.
Yeah.
That's a rational thought. But telling mandated reporters that you're having a thought of harming your kids, that they might be taken away for their safety, that's a rational thought.
Yeah, at the moment it was.
It also shows she knew it was a bad thought, a wrong thought. Because you don't think someone's going to take your kids away because you're thinking something positive or neutral. It's because it's bad. It's because it's wrong. It's because it's against the law. So she knew that it was wrong. And she was able to conform her behavior to the law because she didn't tell those providers. She went in and met with them and talked about what she was experiencing and talked about her depression. And not only did she not tell them, she lied to them. They asked her, are you having thoughts of harming others? Do you have homicidal ideation? She told Tufts no. She told Gelada no. She told Dukes no. She told Goodhart no.
Because she knew what would happen if she told them.
She said no. At MGH, she said no.
That's reasonable.
So not only is she hiding it, she's lying about it. She's controlling her behavior. She's controlling the presentation she presents to her providers. Okay.
The thing that you're missing, however, Frack, is that the woman was having those thoughts, which is not normal. That's the part that's not normal, is the actual having of the thoughts. Having those thoughts of hurting someone, like your child or yourself, is not healthy or good. She's in crisis, and she doesn't know how to handle it. Huh.
Let me get to her being admitted to McLean. You know, up to that point, all of the drugs she's taken from September through December, they weren't given at the same time. The most she ever had at one time was 2 to 3 medications. And usually if it was 3, that third medication was the Benadryl or the hydroxyzine. That's like,
this is so misleading. Over a 4-month period, she had 12 or 13 different medications, and she might have only been taking 2 or 3 of them at a time, but she was on a medication, and then they told her to stop the medication, and then some of the medications she was supposed to titrate, and then some of the medications she was just supposed to start the next day. The overlap of the medications is what probably triggered bipolar and psychosis. How is she trying to sell this to the jury, you guys? Seriously. Am I crazy? Oh my God.
It's like Benadryl or the Ativan or Valium as needed for anxiety. But most of the time it was 2 medications. And the way they did those medications, you heard from Dr. Satoff, a man who's examined thousands of patients
right
with psychosis, who's treated women with postpartum psychosis, who's treated women who have killed their children. That man, who apparently has no expertise, you heard from him that the medication trials were reasonable and rational. She tried a medication, it didn't work, or they had side effects, they stopped the medication. They tried something else. They tried a different combination. And unfortunately, with mental health, there's no blood test or CAT scan or MRI that you can do that says, well, you have bipolar or you have schizophrenia. It unfortunately doesn't work like that. So what the providers have to do is rely on what the patient's telling them, hope that information is accurate, rely on what they're observing about the patient, and make a diagnosis. And then based on that diagnosis, have a treatment plan. And every patient reacts differently to medication. One patient could do fine on it, the next not. So they have to do that trial and error process, and it's normal, it's typical, it's reasonable. And that's what they did for her. And even if you believe that the number of different medications she took over that time or the combination of those medications affected her negatively, after McLean, they were out of her system. Some of them have been out of her system for months. Zoloft, she stopped in October. Other pills she stopped in November or December. And that last one, the Seroquel, that she really had a bad reaction to, is out of her system. The only medication she's on leaving McLean is Trazodone for sleep and Valium for anxiety. And that's it when she leaves there. And why does she leave there? She wants to go to Corey's birthday party. And that's relatable. That's understandable. She wants to be that mom again who can throw her daughter a party and enjoy it. It's completely understandable.
Hold on, I gotta back it up.
But she also knew.
I was peeing and I heard something that is so stupid that you're not even listening to yourself, lady.
Leaves there. And why does she leave there? She wants to go to Corey's birthday party.
Hold on.
That she really had a bad reaction to is out of her system. The only medication she's on.
So she says, let's go back just 1 minute. Sorry.
Affected her negatively. After McLean, they were out of her system. Some of them have been out of her system for months. Zoloft, she stopped in October. Other pills she stopped in November or December.
Okay.
And that last one, the Seroquel, that she really had a bad reaction to.
That one.
Is out of her system. The only medication she's on leaving McLean is Trazodone for sleep.
Okay, she just said she was, all the medications she was on were out of her system, some of them for months. The Zoloft she stopped in October. And what she says here goes against what her own experts told us. Ready? Listen to this.
The only medication she's on leaving McLean is Trazodone for sleep.
Okay.
And Valium for anxiety. And that's it when she leaves there.
So she was prescribed something for anxiety. Did that something affect her bipolar, which your own experts diagnosed her with? some anti-anxiety medications trigger bipolar and psychosis. So you telling the jury that she was clean when she left McLean, she had the drugs out of her system, except for the fact that she was on trazodone. Are you kidding me? It's just so misleading and so disingenuous. And this jury, I hope that they're just like, lady, do you hear yourself? Because that's crazy.
And why does she leave there? He wants to go to Corey's birthday party. And that's relatable. That's understandable. She wants to be that mom again who can throw her daughter a party and enjoy it. It's completely understandable why she would want to leave. But she also knew she wasn't there. She knew how she was feeling. She knew she was depressed. She knew she needed help. But she wanted to be that mom she was more. And there was nothing McLean could do to keep her there. She said she denied suicidal ideation. She denied homicidal ideation. She said she wasn't hearing voices or seeing anything. They saw the entire time she was there, no signs of psychosis. In fact, every doctor she saw, from Tufts in September all the way through Tufts.
She's like, losing her voice. Great.
None of them saw any signs of psychosis ever. So they're all wrong? All these different doctors at all these different...
No, they're not all wrong. They're not all wrong. She was masking symptoms, A, and B, just because you don't have psychosis on Tuesday doesn't mean you're not going to have it on Tuesday night, or that you're going to have a break, or that the second you walk out of that hospital where you are no longer on any of those other drugs besides trazodone and Valium, it doesn't mean that you're not going to have a psychotic break at that point. What the fuck? Do these women think that psychosis is it's not a diagnosis in the DSM apparently. But do these women think that psychosis has to be with you constantly? Like I really do feel like what Red was saying in the beginning of this trial, like they are trying to make it sound like she was supposed to be walking around and drooling and speaking in tongues or something. Psychosis can happen from one minute to the next, which your experts established, and so did the defense's experts. This is so misleading.
Together, wrong? That doesn't make sense. She shows when she's leaving McLean, no signs of psychosis. And they even give her a test to do to see if she can manage her mental health outside of the hospital. Make an appointment, pick a doctor, make an appointment. And she does it. She decides on Dr. Tufts. She makes the follow-up appointment. She gets the documentation and gives it to them, showing she can manage her mental health. They have to let her go at that point. She's there voluntarily. There's no grounds to keep her if she's not showing she's a danger to herself or others. So they let her go home.
Yep.
And at home, again, all throughout January, she's showing her ability to know right from wrong and to conform her behavior to the requirements of the law in all the activities she does in January. First day is the birthday party. She's throwing the birthday party. She's monitoring the kids, making sure, you know, typical mom birthday party stuff. Everyone's eating, getting cake, singing.
I agree with you, Tracy. I agree with you.
Smiling, normal. Everyone that interacted with her said, seemed a little tired, but okay. The Museum of Science. You have that video.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Are we doing this again?
It can be crowded and overwhelming on a good day. And she's there with three kids under five with her husband.
Doing normal mom things.
Doing the exhibits, showing them what to do
with
the exhibits. If you watched that video and you didn't know who the Clancy family was, and we asked you, pick out the woman who is depressed. Pick out the woman who wants to kill herself.
Because all depressed people just sit in a corner in a ball in the fetal position and cry and have panic attacks and drool and speak in tongues. Are you fucking kidding me? It is 2026, ma'am. We know about mental health. We know people mask their symptoms. Is she really expecting this jury to believe this? She's really going to use the Museum of Science and the water park videos? Really? Really?
The woman who's about to kill her kids. You couldn't pick her out. She's completely calm. All her behaviors are typical and normal.
Because she doesn't want to show that shit to her children. Kids pick up on everything. She is trying to put on a good face. You're nuts.
To control her behavior. She's able to be suicidal and feel those things, but control her behavior, control her thoughts, and
yes,
set that image to the world.
Yes.
She's able to do it at the Cape Cotter as well.
Yes.
In scenario.
Absolutely.
She's able to watch the kids when Patrick goes to brunch.
Yep.
She's able to watch the boys
for sure
before go skiing on the 16th.
Yeah.
She's able to interact with the Carneys on January 22nd. And yeah, they both initially said she was quiet, but then they both admitted she was always kind of quiet. But she was able to interact with them, chat with them in the kitchen. Seemed okay.
No, she didn't seem okay. They all pointed out that she didn't seem okay.
Her mother never comes to the house to intervene. Her sister, a licensed social worker, a mandated reporter, never comes to the house to intervene or help, never makes a report. And they're in contact with her every day, texting with her, calling with her almost every day, and never see any signs that they should be concerned or worried or intervene. And you have those text messages between the defendant and her mom. And her mom, obviously, was very attentive, very caring, asked very pointed questions. How are you doing? How are you sleeping? How are the medications? Obviously, a very concerned, loving mom. How did Lindsay answer? I'm getting a little better. I'm sleeping better. She said the only time her sleep was interrupted is if Cora had bellyache or one of the kids was up. But she's doing better every day. She's sleeping better. She's feeling better. She still says, I'm not myself. I'm not where I want to be. But she's moving in the right direction. And we have that text from her mom the day she leaves on the 22nd, headed back home. I'm glad to see you're doing so much better. Now her mom now wants you to believe that she lied to her, that she wasn't doing better and she just is trying to encourage her. But there's so many things you can say to your daughter who's struggling with mental health other than lie to her.
Are you kidding me?
You've got this. Take it day by day. I'm here for you. We're going to get through this.
Are you kidding me?
She wants you to think she lied to her when she said she was doing better. But you know that wasn't a lie. You know that she was doing better or seemed to be and that her mom said...
I'm sorry, guys. I need to take this back. Are you kidding me? And Bruce, I'm sorry, buddy. I am reacting in real time. I don't know what to tell you. I'm going to pause. I'm going to stop. I'm going to respond while she's talking. That's kind of what I do. I'm really sorry, but I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
She's sleeping better.
She is blaming Lindsay's mom the same way that she dealt with Patrick's mom on the stand.
She's feeling better. She still says, I'm not myself. I'm not where I want to be, but she's moving in the right direction. And we have that text from her mom the day she leaves on the 22nd, headed back home. I'm glad to see you're doing so much better. Now her mom now wants you to believe that.
So her mom's lying.
She wasn't doing better and she was just trying to encourage her. But there's so many things you can say to your daughter who's struggling with mental health other than lie to her if you want to encourage her. You've got this. Take it day by day. I'm here for you. We're going to get through this. But she wants you to think she lied to her when she said she was doing better. But you know that wasn't a lie. You know that she was doing better or seemed to be and that her mom said, I'm glad you're doing so much better because Patrick said the same thing. He said she was doing better in January. Every day was better. The 24th was the best day. They had hope because that's what she wanted to show them. The only person during that time that she gave even a little glimpse of
this woman's crazy.
Maybe she wasn't doing that much better was Dr. Tufts. And she told Dr. Tufts that she was feeling depressed, which is why Dr. Tufts prescribed the 10 milligrams of amitriptyline a day. Very low dose. And then she told Dr. Tufts again, still not helping. And so Dr. Tufts raised it to the 20 milligrams. Again, a very low dose, a dose a child could take. And that shows how cautious and conservative Dr. Tufts was being in the treatment of this patient who had had those interactions with medications previously.
I agree,
she was being
Tracy.
Cautious and conservative in acting with care for the patient by slowly increasing the medication. But even with Dr. Tufts, she still denied having a suicide plan, denied wanting to hurt anyone else, denied voices, denied visual hallucinations, showed no signs of psychosis. All the way up to January 23rd, nothing. And if you look at her journal, you look at this journal that defense counsel showed you, she's very detailed, excuse me, about when she took medication, what she took, the amount she took, what the effect was for months, starting in October and going all the way up to January. And where it stops, January 18th, someone who's been so meticulous about everything all the way up to January 18th and it just stops.
Because she was struggling. What?
She decided she's done trying.
No, she doesn't. What?
And she doesn't want to do it anymore. And so she just stops keeping track of the prescriptions.
Wow.
And then we get to January 24th. Everything that happened that day, every person she interacted with, every situation she was in, shows you she knew the difference between right and wrong, and she could conform her behavior to the law. The doctor's appointment first thing in the morning. She's able to drive there. She's able to interact with medical professionals. She's able to seem absolutely fine and normal. And this is a doctor who's treated the kids since Cora was a baby. This is a pediatrician who's known the family and has known Lindsay for almost 5 years.
Okay.
A woman who's trained in recognizing the signs of postpartum depression. She told you she looks for flat affect, she looks for teariness and some other things that she told you. She saw none of that. She was able to control herself and interact with her in a perfectly normal, concerned mother way. Able to get home from that appointment. She plays with the kids. She takes them outside. She's sending those messages.
Okay, we're getting to the part where I might have to fast forward.
Basically saying, look, this is a good day. I'm having a good day. Everything's good. I'm getting better. Here's proof. This is what I'm doing. You start to see the planning at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh my God.
And this is on her phone. You can see her search for Miralax, kids Miralax.
Jesus.
And then a little while later at 4:13, you see her search for takeout from 3V. And then immediately after she does the Apple Maps search to see how long it takes to get to 3V. Well, defense wants you to believe that, you know, she was checking that because she didn't want him gone for too long. She wanted a home. She was in distress. If you're in distress, don't send him anywhere. Make food at home. Have him cook. Get delivery. Get DoorDash. go to one of the other restaurants that Patrick mentioned that were 2 minutes down the road. And she didn't have to look up on Apple Maps to see where this restaurant was. You heard from Patrick. They had been there at least 3 times in the months before.
I've had this question for a while. I just want to address this really quickly because I cannot believe that they are still pushing how she was having a good day. She was having maybe the best day on the 24th. It is well known. It is well documented that people who are suffering psychosis, hypo or manic bipolar spectrum psychosis, have up periods right before they break, basically. So in conditions like bipolar 1, bipolar 2, schizoaffective disorder, psychosis often emerges directly out of mania or hypomania. So a person experiences elevated or euphoric mood, inflated self-esteem, grandiosity, extreme optimism, increased goal-directed activity, and a sharply decreased need for sleep, feeling fully energized after 2 to 3 hours. As the manic acceleration intensifies and sleep deprivation compounds, the heightened confidence and rapid thoughts cross the threshold into full psychosis, manifesting as grandiosity or persecutory delusions, disorganized thought process, and hallucinations. It's called the prodromal or trebma phase. In general, psychotic disorders, including schizophrenia spectrum or acute brief psychosis, the initial phase, clinically described in German psychiatric literature as trema or the delusional mood, frequently mimics an up state. The individual may feel an intense sense of mental clarity, heightened sensory perception, and a feeling that everything around them holds profound hidden significance. And then there's energized agitation rather than euphoric joy. The high is often driven by nervous energy. Postpartum psychosis presentations. Following childbirth, an affected mother may initially appear unusually energetic, joyful, and hyperproductive, waking up early to tackle massive household tasks or running intense fitness regimens despite profound physical recovery demands. In postpartum mood episodes, this elevated high-functioning state frequently alternates rapidly with profound anxiety and depression before escalating into acute hallucinations, confusions, and delusions. And then there's also substance or medication-induced activation. So my point here is every time, like the fact that they didn't even bother to look this up before they said it out of their mouth holes. She was up that day. She felt great. Everything was looking up. Everybody reported she was having a great day. That's what happens right before you have a psychotic break.
In that area for 4 years. She knew where it was. She knew generally how long it would take to get there. What she needed to know was how long specifically on that night it would take to get there, because she knew she would have a limited amount of time to do what she wanted to do. And what she had decided to do was to kill the children and then kill herself. And so she needed to know, not generally, but exactly, how much time will I have? And then obviously sees that that's not enough time. So then she searches CVS. And not only does she search CVS, she calls them and asks them if they have kids Miralax, and they say no, but they have Pedialax and one other medication. And then she asks, is it in stock? Because she needs to know not only what they have, but is it in stock? Because she's adding to this errand that she's sending Patrick out on. And she has to make sure she's not interrupted. She doesn't want that call at 5:33. She wants him to go. To CVS and have the medication there and get it and then go on to 3V. So she has time to do what she needs to do.
18 minutes.
So that's why she's calling to see what they have and make sure it's in stock. It's a level of planning there and thinking and decision making that Dr. Sathoff referenced.
Never, it doesn't matter.
And then after that, she texts Patrick, you know, it's been a long day. Can we do 3V? And he's on board with that. And she's like, okay, check out the menu. Let's get on this. And he asks her what she's getting. She tells him the Mediterranean Power Bowl. He says he's getting the pork belly risotto. 5:10 p.m., she's calling that order in. She's talking to the hostess. She gets the order accurate. She is able to answer questions about how she wants her food. She's able to recall and give Patrick's phone number and his name as the person picking up.
And clarity.
Patrick's leaving to go get the food. And as he's leaving, the kids are in the living room on the couch eating. The defendant's in the doorway near the basement door. And she says to him, Oh, basically, oh, by the way, can you go to CVS? Acting like it's this last minute thought, like, oh, by the way, can you get this? And not something that she's been planning for over an hour. She knew about the Pedialyte and she knew about 3D and she knew all of that before she even asked him about dinner. But it's like, oh, can you go to CVS on your way and get kids Pedialyte? And he, of course, is like, sure, I'll get that. And he heads out the door at 5:15. And you know that's the time he leaves because he says to her, yeah, just text it to me. And that's such a normal kind of interaction that we have here.
Yeah, the whole thing's normal.
You're at the door to run an errand and someone says, like, oh, well, oh, can you get me X, Y, and Z? And you're like, yeah, sure, just text it to me. Because you don't want to get there and be like, oh, what did they want me to get? It's such a normal interaction, right? Can you get this for me? Sure, text it to me. And he heads out the door and she texts it to him at 5:15 p.m. And then he goes to CVS, even though she's told him what to get and they have it, he still makes that call at 5:33. She calls him back at 5:34. And then he heads out to 3V and then comes home. And when he gets home, puts the things on the counter and it's quiet. It's quiet in a way that a house with three kids under five should not be during waking hours. So he calls out to them, no answer. He goes to the basement door and opens it and yells down, and no answer. And he closes the door. He calls her phone, no answer. He goes upstairs and is able to unlock the door and see the blood and see the window open and go down to her. And when he goes down to her, she's no longer actively bleeding. He doesn't have to put pressure on any of her wounds. And
oh, she, no, no. She's no longer actively bleeding from the 3 centimeter deep slice on her neck and her wrists and the internal bleeding and hitting her head and paralysis. She's no longer bleeding. She's fine. She's fine.
And her response is, I tried to kill myself.
Yep.
And then it's, where are the kids? In the basement. It's not, I heard a voice. I was compelled to do this. I didn't want to do this. Go help the kids. They're hurt. They're in the basement. Go save them. No. It's, I tried to kill myself. And the kids are in the basement. And defense wants you to believe that conversation couldn't have happened because of how she sounded on the 911 call. But you heard from the doctors, people can deteriorate over time. When he first gets there, she's able to talk to him. And as that progresses, she's losing the ability to talk. And there's nothing in the medical records about her throat being crushed or her thyroid being crushed. You can look at that. Her thyroid was bruised. Her vertebrae were broken, but her throat wasn't crushed. She had the ability to make sound.
She's fine. She was totally fine.
And if you listen to the 911, he's talking to her, and then he's answering the 911 dispatchers about what she said. So even if we can't hear her clearly and we can't understand what she was saying, he could.
And then?
You know, from all of the evidence that you have, putting aside the experts, but all the evidence you have in terms of crime scene photos and videos and the witness testimony and all the medical records, you know how she killed them, where she killed them, what time she killed them, because you know, in order to bring the kids to the basement, the pills, cuts themselves, and whether she dove out or climbed out and slid down, whatever you think that evidence shows from the shingles and everything you've seen, whatever happened, she goes out of the window and she's on the ground. And by the time Patrick gets there, she's no longer bleeding.
So what?
For all of that to happen in that short amount of time while Patrick's gone, she had to have started killing the kids immediately. That after the phone call, she heard the voice and killed the children. She gets the call. She's at the fridge. Austin is sitting on the couch. Yes, the pink one seems to have the impelled.
Sorry, guys. Got to skip through it.
Actions that she's controlling. So she has to explain away the phone call because her behavior and her ability to have the phone call don't make sense if she's being compelled by her voice, if she's not in control. And you, further on that, you have the phone. You have the flights climbed. There were two flights climbed. You can see, you have Ian Whiffen's report. You can see there were two flights climbed. The first ends at 5:33. So it makes sense that she has killed the kids in the basement and she has to, making sure it's on stock, all of that. And he still calls her. He still interrupts her. And then she gets the knife and she 5:33 to just before 5:35. So if you want to believe that the voice happened after the call and the killing of the kids happened after the call, between 5:33 and 5:38, she doesn't go down and come back up and come back up and come back up. There's nothing on that phone about that. And there wouldn't be enough time for her to bring those kids down to the basement and strangle Eva included. It could take you for another 1 to 2 minutes to cause death.
Okay, and just to hammer a little point home here. I don't want to get too technical here because we're talking specifically about the kids. Their experts are the ones who testified that she did, in fact, walk each kid into the basement separately. And so if her phone isn't showing you that, it means she set her phone down somewhere else on the kitchen table or wherever it might have been. So, again, like, they don't even know their own evidence. It's insane to me.
Dr. Lapisada wanted you to believe that the van could just stay there around their necks, not back. I had to hold them up to show them around someone's neck on their own. So I'll take this.
Your off. Own witness. Okay. La, la, la. I couldn't show you guys what she was talking about because she's talking about the exercise band again and her stupid demonstration. I just want to make the point that their own witness, Patrick Clancy, the first witness they called to the stand, the father of these children and the ex-husband of Lindsey Clancy, literally said on the stand when you asked him that he had to untie the exercise band and that it was tied like you would tie your shoelaces in a bow, but you didn't do the bow part. You're going to hammer this point home? Wow. Wicked smart.
He testified that he didn't have a clear memory, but he remembered that they were possibly looped. And I asked him, like, when you're tying your shoe, that first loop before you do a bow? And he said, yeah, kind of like that. So not knotted, not tied. But even his memory wasn't the best. You heard him on that call.
Wow.
And that's why we had to play the call for you, because you could hear him. You could hear when he found each kid. And you knew that he had the phone with him when he found each kid, because his voice, it never sounded like he was in another room. It always sounded so painfully right there. And so you know he's holding the phone and he's not untying knots, and he wouldn't have had the time to untie knots in that short amount of time. And then you have the firefighters looking in the window, seeing him with Dawson, and he's not untying a knot.
Yes, that's what the testimony said. What?
Unlooping something. They say they see him and then unwind to show, because those weren't knotted. They weren't tied. And even if you wanted to believe that, at 5:38, she goes upstairs and puts the phone on the bed, and then she goes down and kills the kids, and she does everything. 5:38 to just after 6 p.m. because he's making the call to her at 6:09. There was not enough time between 5:38 and just after 6 p.m. to kill all three kids, to get 20 odd minutes. It's not enough. When she got the call from him, she had already strangled them. Like, done. She's a nurse. She stayed calm. She presented herself as normal. She had complete control over her behavior and her emotions.
Wow.
She had a normal conversation with him because she didn't want him coming home, because she needed to finish her plan. She still had to kill herself. So why did she do it? No, defense would have you believe that a mother who was this good, who loved her kids this much, which we're not denying, would never harm her kids this way unless she was so mentally ill that she was hearing these command voices and had no choice.
Yeah, basically.
But. You know, that's not the world we live in.
What?
I told you, most women who kill their children do it in child abuse. Most women who kill their children don't do it because of mental illness. Mothers kill their children, and it's horrible, and it's awful, but it happens. So why did she specifically do it? She was depressed. She was exhausted. She was done.
She was suffering postpartum psychosis.
But those kids were her protective factor. Those kids were keeping her from ending her misery.
She stayed up all night writing this, you guys.
So she had to remove the protective factor. And I'm not saying she was happy about it. I'm saying that it was what she had to do to end her misery.
This is so despicable.
But it was a choice. It was a choice. She could have kept trying. She could have, you know, moved down to her mother's. She could have killed herself and left her kids alive. But it was a choice to take them with her. It was a horrible choice. And it's a choice that we don't want to think about, that a mother could make, because that doesn't make us feel safe or comfortable in this world. But it's a choice she made. She knew it was wrong, because she sent Patrick out to do it. She could conform her behavior, because she waited until he was gone and didn't tell him what was going on those phone calls, didn't call 911 for help, didn't lock herself in a bathroom upon hearing this voice. She knew it was wrong. She didn't take advantage of this situation. She created this situation, this opportunity to do what she wanted.
Wow. They are really not reading the room.
And she knew she was alive and the kids weren't. She knew what she did was wrong. She said she felt horrified.
Yeah.
And then, while still with a tube in her throat, she's asking, do I have a lawyer?
Yeah.
And it's not what defense said. It was after surgery and she's delirious. Look at the records. She had surgery on the 27th. She's asking if she has a lawyer on the 26th. Do I have a lawyer? Because she knows what she did was wrong. And then we get the justification, the excuse of the voice. And there are a few reasons why the voice doesn't make sense. The first is she immediately obeyed it. Dr. Resnick, their expert, the one who knows everything about postpartum psychosis. He teaches other psychiatrists and psychologists. He writes books and chapters and articles about how this is a huge red flag if someone immediately obeys.
Take a drink of water.
We're going to talk about Andrea Yates, about how she heard voices to kill her children for months. And what did she do? She committed herself 5 times. She tried to kill herself twice to avoid harming her children. That was all accurate.
Let's move on from that.
Lindsey Clancy hears his voice one time.
Wait, what?
Doesn't try to walk herself.
We're talking about Yates, and he tells her to move.
For months. And what did she do? She committed herself 5 times. She tried to kill herself twice to avoid harming her children. That was all accurate.
Let's move on from that.
Lindsey Clancy hears his voice one time and does it. Doesn't try to lock herself in the bathroom, call Patrick, call 911. Doesn't try to leave. You know, yeah, leaving little children alone for 20, 30 minutes, not the greatest option, but it's better than killing them. She doesn't try any tactics to avoid the voice. She disobeys. Another red flag that Resnick was asked about and teaches and writes about is that she only heard the voice one time. She never heard it before, and she hasn't heard it since. Somehow that works. It's a red flag.
That is how that works.
Another one is that what she said, the voice told her, isn't consistent. At the hospital, she says the voice said, you have to kill your children so you can kill yourself because they'll suffer without you. What she tells a lot of the doctors is, it says this is your life.
Hold on a sec. I just want to, this moment where he told her to move on from Andrea Yates. Okay. The judge intervened to stop her from referencing the Andrea Yates case because closing argument primarily, because of Massachusetts evidentiary rules prohibiting comparing the defendant to infamous crimes not in evidence and arguing facts outside of the record. Under Massachusetts law, attorneys in closing arguments are strictly confined to the evidence admitted during the trial and reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that evidence. While the name Andrea Yates has been mentioned briefly during witness testimony, such as nurse Margaret Hamp recounting an early career conversation with Lindsay, who expressed horror at the Yates case, the legal facts, trial outcome, psychiatric details, and specifics of Andrea Yates' Texas trials were never admitted into evidence, and attempting to compare Lindsey Clancy's behavior, motives, or legal sanity to Andrea Yates' actions in closing arguments constitutes arguing facts outside of the record. The judge also might have been worried about a risk of distraction, false legal standards. Texas and Massachusetts are under completely different statutes and laws. Texas uses very strict mental tests. Massachusetts follows a sort of broader tests for volition and conformity. And then also it's a high profile case that probably a lot of people already know about. It's prejudicial to the jury. So those are all the reasons why he told her to move on and why Reddington actually objected, which I thought was smart.
It's your last chance. You have to kill the kids so you can kill yourself. And then she tells the chaplain, you have to kill the kids so you can kill yourself because they're in danger. There's these three different versions. Another flag red flag, it doesn't make sense that she's saying the voice says all these different things. And then the fourth thing that doesn't make sense about the voice is that it's vague in its command. It doesn't tell her how to kill the kids, where, with what.
Why would it?
What? Kill the kids and you can kill yourself.
Wait, is there a textbook on what command voices, like how they're supposed to command? Are they supposed to say, well, you walk into this place and you grab this weapon and you walk up to this very specific person who happens to be blonde and you cut, like, what? How does she fucking know what command voices are supposed to sound like and what they're supposed to say? Nobody knows.
Had to choose where, the basement. She had to choose how, strangulation. She had to choose with what, exercise band. Choose again, exercise band. Choose again, exercise band. She had to choose how to kill herself. Now, if you're being compelled by this voice and you have no free will whatsoever, you're just doing, your body's acting on the voice, why wouldn't you just kill yourself the same way you killed the children? You strangled them, you hang yourself.
Are you kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me? Are you kidding me? Did she just say that?
Choose again, exercise band. She had to choose how to kill herself. Now, if you're being compelled by this voice and you have no free will whatsoever, you're just doing, your body's acting on the voice, why wouldn't you just kill yourself the same way you killed the children? You strangled them, you hang yourself.
Well, that sounds scientific.
That's no choice. She tried 3 different ways. None of them similar to what happened to the kids. And I'll take this other quarter now and explain to you why we got into the superficiality.
She's taking the quarters away. She thinks that's a power move.
Why we got into how she didn't take enough pills to actually kill herself. We're not saying she didn't want to kill herself. We're talking about that third prong of suicidality that Dr. Satow talked about. Remember, he talked about aloneness and feeling burdensome, but that third category, capability. She wanted to kill herself, but her natural instinct to live was fighting against that. So she took pills, but you heard the toxicologist, they were all at therapeutic levels or below, except the Seroquel, which was a little elevated. She cut herself, but you saw the cuts on the meaty part of her arm, horizontally. No arteries, no major blood vessels. Didn't need to be stitched the next day.
Oh my God.
The one on her neck didn't need to be stitched at all. She knew as a nurse, those weren't going to kill her, but she was trying. And then going out of the window, 12, 13 feet, she landed the wrong way and ended up paralyzed on the frozen ground. But you know, the idea that falling out of a 12 foot window is going to definitely kill you, not necessarily. And so
we're really still pushing the idea that she tried to fake her unaliving. Are we really on day 22, August 27th, 2026, in the year of our Lord, we are still pushing the fake unaliving narrative? Are you kidding me, ma'am?
She was trying in all these different ways, but she just couldn't get over that third prong, the capability of actually killing herself. And that goes against it being a voice. Because if she's compelled to do it, if this voice is making her do it, she would just do it. There would be no fight. There would be no struggle. There would be no resistance to dying. But there was.
Can this be over?
The third one is Dr. Zeisel. We've never said that.
Oh.
He told.
Oh, you didn't even get your... You even fucked up the quarters. You thought that was your big power move and you didn't even get it right. You're an embarrassment. You sit the fuck down.
The defendant, what to say? Not one witness, not one piece of evidence. The only person that said that Dr. Zeisel, that we were trying to say Dr. Zeisel told her to make up the voice, is defense counsel. He's the only one that asked about it. He's the only one that brought it up. We have never said that in this courtroom, and no witness has said that we've asked. She knew what she did was wrong. She could conform her behavior to the law and chose not to.
Bullshit.
And she didn't expect to have any consequences because she expected to die with her children. And we get to what we have to prove is that first degree is deliberate premeditation and extreme atrocity and cruelty. You know it was deliberate premeditation because of the way she killed them and the way they died. And the order also shows a rationality, the order she killed them in. Because Hoare and Dawson are older. They would have ran off and hid. So taking Dawson first, data proves
what
she knew
fuck?
That he might struggle.
What the fuck?
5 or 10 seconds that until he went on. She continued strangling. It's being done by their mom with dreams, with futures. Individually, she killed them. And then discarded on the basement floor like broken toys.
It's clear.
Oh my God, that was the end? I can't even play it.
You know to a moral certainty. She is guilty.
Hold on.
Leaving them peacefully there. No. She left them. You know to a moral certainty. She is guilty.
So basically what she's saying is she left them in the basement like discarded toys. I'm sure she worked on that line for a very long time. So basically they just flip-flopped the opening with the closing. They started the opening trying to like prey on the emotions of the jury by automatically going into Cora. You know, like saying all the names of the children, all that, everything they did in the opening. They flip-flopped it. And they ended with it to leave that with the jury. There were so many lies in what she just said. I hope that the jury knows that. And I think that they put on a really shitty case. I'm going to go back and watch that moment on my own, Kylie, because I hadn't seen it yet. And I know you've been telling me to watch it, but it was the way that she was explaining what happened. Like, I can't play that for the audience. That's not what we're here for. And also, I don't want to get struck if that's what's actually happening out there in these streets. So the whole thing was insane, though. I mean, the whole thing was delusional. Ugh.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
They should be ashamed of themselves.
See you here for what? Maybe need a short break. I think that would. All right. So we're going to return now to the instructions that I have. In rereading my instructions, I just kind of want to make sure that something's clear. So I'm going to ask you to go back to page 6. I think we were talking about murder in the second degree. Everybody get there.
So negative 126.
All right.
We got like half an hour to an hour.
That
there's Bob.
You may consider the defendant's mental condition at the time of the killing, including any credible evidence of mental impairment or the effect on the defendant for consumption of prescription drugs in determining any of the elements in the murder in the second degree charge as well. I mentioned that for some of the others, but specifically for the charge in murder second degree, there's an element regarding intent. Okay. So I just kind of wanted to make that clear. Probably suggested in that, but as I read through it, I just kind of wanted to remind you that you can.
Ice skater Kylie was telling me that how she closed out her closing argument was just ludicrous. And she was basically using the kids and like what Kylie said, that she expected Lindsay to like build a shrine to her children in the basement. I don't know. It's not something that I can play right now. So if you want to go back and watch it, feel free. We're going to go into the actual jury instructions now. The verdict instructions, not the verdict instructions, the jury instructions. And this is probably going to take a little bit. I do have it on 1.5. I might try to speed it up a little bit.
And as I said, you can consider the defendant's mental condition at the time of the killing, including any credible evidence of mental impairment or the effect on the defendant for consumption of prescription drugs in determining the elements in murder in the second degree. All right. So I hope that cleared things up rather than confusing you any. Now I'm going to go to the general principles in regards to this case. All right. Now, as I said to you before, I'm incorporating the instructions that I gave earlier before the closing arguments with these instructions. So I want to talk about the presumption of innocence and the burden of proof. Once again, the indictments against Ms. Clancy are only an accusation. They're not evidence. The defendant has denied that she's guilty of the crimes charged in these indictments. The law presumes the defendant to be innocent of the charges against her. This presumption of innocence is a rule of law that compels you to find the defendant not guilty unless and until the Commonwealth produces evidence from whatever source that proves that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. This burden of proof never shifts. The defendant is not required to call any witnesses or produce any evidence since she is presumed to be innocent. The presumption of innocence stays with the defendant unless and until the evidence convinces you unanimously as a jury that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It requires you to find the defendant not guilty unless your guilt has been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Your verdict, whether it is guilty or not guilty, must be unanimous. All right. Now, reasonable doubt. The burden is on the Commonwealth to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of the charges made against her, as I just told you. But what is proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Well, the term is often used in probably
totally another charge.
It's not easily defined. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean proof beyond all possible doubt. For everything in the lives of human beings is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. The charge is proved beyond a reasonable doubt if, after you've compared and considered all of the evidence, you have in your minds an abiding conviction to a moral certainty that the charge is true. When we refer to moral certainty, we mean the highest degree of certainty possible in matters relating to human affairs based solely on the evidence that has been put before you in this case. I told you that every person is presumed to be innocent until she is proved guilty and that the burden of proof is on the prosecutor. If you evaluate all the evidence and you still have a reasonable doubt remaining, the defendant is entitled to the benefit of that doubt and must be acquitted. It is not enough for the Commonwealth to establish a probability, even a strong probability, that the defendant is more likely to be guilty than not guilty. That is not enough. Instead, the evidence must convince you of the defendant's guilt to a reasonable and moral.
And guys, keep in mind that both of these women, here, I will tell you their exact. They're both on like the children's advocacy, something or other. And I'm like, oh my God. Buckingham. Sprague. Hold on a second. They both work on. They told the judge they weren't pushing that. You're absolutely right. They kept, remember how they, I think what you're talking about is Lindsay faking her unaliving or her attempted unaliving. They told the judge that they were not saying she faked it. And they just told the jury something else. Like these women, they've been, so Shannon Buckingham is chief of the family protection unit. Just so you know. Outside of this trial, Buckingham serves as the chief of the family protection unit within the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office. They direct, oversee the prosecution of sensitive, high vulnerability offenses across the county and the types of cases. So that's why they're on these cases, because she is the chief of the family protection unit. Yes. The types of cases that they supervise: child physical abuse and child sexual assault, domestic and intimate partner violence, sexual assault and rape prosecutions, crimes against the elderly and vulnerable individuals. She supervises specialized assistant district attorneys, dedicated victims, victim witness advocates, and specialized forensic investigators assigned to family violence and child trauma cases. And Jennifer Sprague, FRAC, she serves in top executive trial leadership as the second assistant district attorney for Plymouth County. She operates as one of the primary executive level prosecutors in the office, answering directly to the first assistant district attorney and district attorney Timothy Cruz. She handles homicides and prosecutions. She does superior court supervision, and she does grand jury and strategy. But keep in mind, Shannon Buckingham, Bo Peep, Frick, is the chief of the Family Protection Unit. Terrifying.
Certainty, the certainty that convinces your understanding and satisfies your reason in judgment as jurors who are sworn to act conscientiously on the evidence. This is what we mean by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I want to talk initially about my function of the judge. My function as a judge in this case has been to see that the trial was conducted fairly, efficiently, and in an orderly manner.
I'm glad you're here, Kylie.
It's also my responsibility to rule on what you may consider as evidence and to instruct you on the law that applies in this case. It's your duty, as jurors in this case, to accept the law as I stated to you. You should consider all of my instructions as a whole. You may not ignore any instruction or give special attention to any one instruction. You must follow the law as I give it to you, whether you agree with it or not. That's not just because I'm the judge. It's because every person who comes to court for trial is equal and is subject to the same law. And if jurors in each case were to apply what they thought the law should be, and the jurors in different cases had different views, then the parties in those cases would not be treated equally. The law that I'm instructing you on is the law that has been established by our legislature and our appellate courts, and it applies to everyone. And you must apply the law as I instruct you. Function of the jury. Your function is to determine the facts of this case. You are the sole and exclusive judges of the facts. You alone determine what evidence to accept, how important any evidence is that you do accept,
I will be
and what
right
conclusions
back, guys.
To draw from all the evidence. You must apply the law as I give it to you, to the facts as you determine them to be, in order to decide whether the Commonwealth has proven its case. You should determine the facts solely on a fair consideration of the evidence. You are to be completely fair and impartial, and you are not to be swayed by prejudice, by personal likes or dislikes towards either side, or by any personal view you may have the nature of the claims or the defenses in the case. Your decisions must rest solely on the facts that you find and the law that I give you in these instructions. Nor are you to be influenced by any personal likes or dislikes you've come to feel towards any party or any attorney. In this courtroom, every person is equal and is entitled to a fair and impartial verdict in accordance with the evidence and the law. You are not to decide this case based on anything you may have read or heard outside of this courtroom. That, with the exception of that, is the observations you made at that view, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. You are not to engage in any guesswork about any unanswered questions that remain in your mind, or to speculate about what the quote-unquote real facts might or might not have been, beyond what has been proved by the evidence. You should not consider anything that I've said or done during the trial as any indication of any opinions as to how you should decide this case. If you believe that I've expressed or hinted at any opinion about the facts of this case, please disregard it. I have no opinion about the facts or what your verdict ought to be. That is solely and exclusively your duty and your responsibility. Now, I'll talk about function of counsel. It was the duty of the lawyers in this case to object when the other side offered evidence which that lawyer believed was not admissible under our law. They also had an obligation to ask to speak to me at the sidebar about questions of law, which the law requires me to rule on outside of your hearing. The purpose of such objections in rulings is not to keep relevant information from you. You should not draw any inference, favorable or unfavorable, to any attorney or their client for objecting to proposed evidence or asking me to make such rulings. That is the function and responsibility of the attorneys in this case. Now, what is evidence? As I told you, you are to decide what the facts are solely from the evidence admitted in this case and not from suspicion or conjecture. The evidence consists of the testimony of witnesses, as you recall, and any documents, photographs, or videos, or other things that were received into evidence as exhibits. You may also consider any observations that you made while at the view that we took earlier in the trial. In this case, there may be certain documents or photographs that are entered multiple times. This does not mean that that evidence is any more or less important than any other evidence. You, the jurors, will decide how to evaluate the evidence, that is, what weight to put to it. Now, in reviewing documents and evidence, you might find that there's some information that's been whited out or redacted. This is because the court has made some legal rulings about what evidence is relevant to this case. You should not draw any negative inference against either party based on these redactions, nor are you to speculate about what information has been redacted. In addition, a couple of stipulations were entered into evidence during the course of this trial. A stipulation is an agreement that has been made between the parties. The contents of such stipulation may be accepted by you as facts and relied on you along with other facts that you find based on the evidence. Of course, the quality or strength of the proof is not determined by the sheer volume of evidence or the number of witnesses or exhibits. It's the weight of the evidence, its strength, intending to prove the issue at stake, that's important. Some things that occur during a trial are not evidence, and you may not consider them as evidence in deciding the facts of this case. A question put to a witness is never evidence. Only the answers are evidence. So if a witness agrees with a fact or a proposition contained in a question, then the fact or proposition agreed to is evidence. However, If a witness disagrees with a fact or proposition contained in a question, then the fact or proposition is not evidence simply because it was suggested in the question. You would have to look elsewhere for evidence about that issue. You may not consider any answers that I've stricken. They're not evidence and cannot be used by you as evidence or considered by you for any purpose. The opening statement and closing arguments of the lawyers, not evidence. They're only intended to assist you in understanding the positions of the party. My instructions, anything that I've said during the trial, not evidence. All right. So if your memory of the testimony differs from the attorney's or mine, you are to follow your own recollection. You must consider the evidence as a whole. Now, I want to talk about direct and circumstantial evidence. There are two types of evidence that you may use to determine the facts in this case. There's direct evidence and there's circumstantial evidence. The law allows both direct and circumstantial evidence in a criminal case, and circumstantial evidence alone may be sufficient to establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Direct evidence is when a witness testifies directly about the fact that is sought to be proved based upon what he or she claims to have seen, heard, or felt with their own senses. And the question there is whether you believe that witness or not. Circumstantial evidence is Circumstantial evidence is when no witness can testify directly about the fact that sought to be proved, but you are presented with evidence of other facts and then asked to draw reasonable inferences from them about the fact that sought to be proved. There are, however, several things you should keep in mind about circumstantial evidence.
I thought I would bring a snorty little emotional support dog out for y'all. Just for a little bit. It's too hot out here for this one. She can't breathe very well sometimes. This is Ruby, for those of you who don't know. This is Ruby Jean. She used to be named Dolly because of her nipples. Poor Dolly. We miss Dolly, huh? That's very sad. All right. Yeah, I figured you guys might need some Ruby right now.
The first one is that you may draw inferences and conclusions only from facts that have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
The second rule
is that any inferences or conclusions you draw must be reasonable and natural based on your common sense and good judgment. In a chain of circumstantial evidence, it's not required that every one of your inferences and conclusions be inevitable, but it is required that each of them be reasonable, that they all be consistent with one another, and that together they establish the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Inferences must never be based on conjecture, surmise, guesswork, or assumption. And whether the evidence is direct or circumstantial, the Commonwealth must prove the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt from all of the evidence presented in the case. Now I want to talk about the credibility of witnesses. All right.
We're almost
done. It's going to be your duty to decide all the disputed questions of fact. You're going to have to determine which witnesses to believe and how much weight to give their testimony. You should give the testimony of each witness whatever degree of belief and importance that you judge it is fairly entitled to receive. You are the sole judges of the credibility of the witnesses, and if there are any conflicts in the testimony, it's your function to resolve those conflicts and to determine where the truth lies. You may believe everything a witness says, or only part of it, or none of it at all. If you do not believe a witness's testimony that something happened, of course your disbelief is not evidence that it did not happen. When you disbelieve a witness, it just means that you have to look elsewhere for credible evidence about that issue. And when deciding whether to believe a witness and how much importance to give a witness's testimony, you must look at all the evidence, drawing on your own common sense and experience of life. Often it may be not what a witness says, but how the witness says it that might give you a clue whether or not to accept that witness's version of an event as believable. You may consider a witness's appearance and demeanor on the witness stand, the frankness or lack of frankness in testifying, whether the testimony is reasonable or unreasonable, probable or improbable. You may take into account how good an opportunity the witness had to observe the facts about which the witness testifies, the degree of intelligence the witness shows, and whether the witness's memory seems accurate. You may also consider any motive that the witness may have for testifying and whether the witness displays any bias in testifying and whether or not the witness has any interest in the outcome of the case. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about prior inconsistent statements. When you evaluate the testimony the witness gave here in court, you may consider whether that witness made any earlier statements that differ from or contradict in any way their in-court testimony. That earlier statement is generally admitted into evidence solely for your consideration in evaluating the witness's credibility or believability. If you determine that an earlier statement is different from the way the witness testified in court, you may decide that the witness's credibility or believability is affected adversely, or you may decide that it's not adversely affected, but that is the only purpose for which you may use that earlier statement. You may not consider the earlier statement as evidence or proof of truth of any fact contained in the statement. Now, flip side, I want to talk about prior consistent statements now, all right? The testimony of a witness may be rehabilitated or supported by showing that he or she previously made statements that are consistent with their present testimony. The prior statement is admitted into evidence solely for your consideration in evaluating the credibility of the witness. Should you find a prior statement to be consistent, you may consider the prior statement only in connection with your evaluation of the credence to be given to the witness's present testimony in court. You are not to consider the prior statement as establishing the truth of any facts contained in that statement. Now, I want to talk about the defendant's statements that were made to evaluating psychiatrists or psychologists. You may not consider the defendant's statements made to a psychiatrist or psychologist in their evaluation of the defendant as establishing the truth of any facts contained therein. Those statements cannot be used by you as evidence of premeditation, extreme atrocity, or cruelty, or specific intent to kill. Such statements are admissible only as they relate to the basis of the doctor's opinion of the defendant's mental condition. Now, I want to talk about evidence of post-incident conduct. Now, you have heard some evidence suggesting the defendant's actions after the killings. I'm not suggesting that these are the facts, because the facts are your exclusive domain. But there is some evidence to that effect, and I mention it here to describe the legal point that's implicated. If the Commonwealth has proven that a defendant did any of these things, you may consider whether such actions indicate feelings or consciousness of guilt by the defendant, and whether in turn such feelings of guilt might tend to show the defendant's actual guilt of the offenses with which he's been charged. You are not, however, required to draw such inferences, and you should not do so unless they appear to be reasonable in light of all the circumstances in this case. If you decide that such inferences are reasonable, it will be up to you to determine how much importance to give them. But you should always remember that there may be numerous reasons why a person not responsible for the crimes charged might do the things attributed to her. Such conduct does not necessarily reflect feelings or consciousness of guilt. So please bear in mind that a person having feelings of guilt is not necessarily guilty. In fact, for such feelings are sometimes found in innocent people. So finally, remember that standing alone, consciousness of guilt evidence, if you find it was any, is never enough by itself to convict a person of a crime. You may not find the defendant guilty on such evidence alone, but you may consider it in your deliberations along with all the other evidence that was presented at the trial. I want to talk next about expert witnesses. Now, there are a number of expert witnesses in this case. This term refers to witnesses who have specialized training or experience in a particular field. Generally, in cases that are tried in our courts, both civil and criminal, witnesses may testify only to facts that are within their own personal knowledge, that is, things they have personally seen or heard or felt. Because a particular witness has specialized training in their field does not put that witness on a higher level than any other witness, and you are to treat an expert witness just as you would treat any other witness. You may believe all of the expert's testimony, none of it, or anything between those two extremes. There is no requirement for you to believe an expert merely because they are an expert. As with any other witness, it's completely up to you to decide whether you accept the testimony of an expert witness, including the opinions that the witness gave. It's also entirely up to you to decide whether you accept the facts relied on by the expert and decide what conclusions, if any, you draw from the expert's testimony. You must, as has been explained, keep firmly in mind that you alone decide what the facts are. If you conclude that an expert's opinion is not based on the facts as you find those facts to be, then you may reject the testimony and the opinion of the expert in whole or in part. You're also free to reject the testimony and the opinion of an expert witness
in whole or in part
if you determine that the witness's opinion is not based on sufficient education, experience, or that the testimony of the witness was motivated by some bias or interest in this case.
Dr. Hack.
Now, you may have noticed that Ms. Clancy did not testify at this trial. The defendant has an absolute right not to testify, since the entire burden of proof in this case is on the Commonwealth to prove that the defendant is guilty. It is not up to the defendant to prove that she is innocent. Under our system of law, a defendant has a perfect right to say to the Commonwealth, quote, you have the burden of proving your case against me beyond a reasonable doubt. I do not have to say a word, unquote. The fact that the defendant did not testify has nothing to do with the question of whether she's guilty or not guilty. You are not to draw any adverse inference against the defendant because she did not testify. You are not to consider it in any way or even discuss it in your deliberations. You must determine whether the Commonwealth has proved its case against the defendant based solely on the testimony of the witnesses and the exhibits. Now, speaking of exhibits, now I'm going to talk about that. You will have all the exhibits and the stipulations with you in the jury room. If there's a need to play an exhibit or view one, the court will make a computer available for you to use. The things you heard me say we're marking for identification only are not evidence, and you're not going to have those items with you in the jury room because they're not technically part of the evidence. We marked them so we could keep track of them as we went from witness to witness, and there'd be a clear record of some of the rulings I made. So coming back, however, the exhibits that were introduced in evidence, you'll have those with you. You alone will decide the weight that they deserve to receive and help you make your ultimate judgment about whether the Commonwealth has proven its case. You're not required to believe something simply because it's written on a piece of paper or it appears in a photograph. You're not, of course, required to disbelieve it just because it appears there either. Whether to believe what an exhibit purports
so
to
much
show,
work to
how
do.
Much weight to give the exhibit is entirely up to you to decide. Now, the view, early in the trial, we drove by some sites and visited an address in Duxbury. As I told you at the time, we referred to that as a view. The purpose of the view was to help you better understand the evidence that you heard during the trial and to help you appreciate the location and its surroundings. The view is part of the case. The observations that you made while on the view may be used and considered in your deliberations in reaching a verdict. Now, I want to talk a little bit about some photographs. The Commonwealth has introduced certain photographs depicting the victims. You'll have those photographs with you during your deliberations. The images depicted are not pleasant. As I instructed you at the time they were introduced, your verdict must not in any way be influenced by the fact that these images are unpleasant or graphic. The defendant is entitled to a verdict based solely on the evidence, and not one based on pity or sympathy for the decedents, which might be occasioned by the images depicted. Consider those exhibits only as they may draw attention to a clinical, medical status, or nature of the victim's injuries, the cause of their death, or to the nature of the incident itself. Now, about notes. At the outset of the case, I spoke to you regarding the use of notes, and I want to repeat at this time, your notes are only an aid to memory and should not be given any precedent over your independent recollection of the facts. Whether you took notes or you didn't, you must rely on your own memory. Do not use your notes to try to persuade your fellow jurors of the accuracy of your reflections, and no juror should be influenced by the notes of other jurors. Your notes are not official or even unofficial transcripts, all right? Now, we'll talk about the use of phones or computers. During your deliberations, you must not communicate with or provide any information to anyone by any means about this case. You may not use any electronic device or media, such as a computer or a phone, to communicate to anyone any information about this case or to conduct any research about this case until I accept your verdict. Kind of want to make that real clear, all right? So if somebody has a question in that jury room, you are not allowed to try and answer it by anything other than through the exhibits and evidence you've heard, all right? So I just kind of want to make that real clear. Nobody is to use a phone to communicate, to try and look. I don't talk to anybody while you're deliberating. Don't try and look up anything, things like that, all right? Just kind of make that as clear as I can. Before I go any farther, I have to do one more duty, and that's to select a foreperson of the jury. We have a foreperson for two purposes. The first is to act.
We're not going to be able to see the jury. What we do know is that they chose randomly 9 women and 3 men. So that's where we're at. And this case is now with the jury, and we are on verdict watch. It looks like past the 1 hour mark. All right, so I'm going to keep this going in the background for myself. But why is there... Interesting that there's a scrum set up, media scrum. Let's see what this guy has to say. Hold on.
Altruistic filicide is what their expert talked about, where she didn't want them to...
She's withholding these thoughts, obviously, but was it because she was optimistic that she would get over it? She didn't want to lose the kids.
Okay, they're just... No, we're not going to pay attention to that. I'm just trying to figure out why there is a media scrum set up. Verdict clock is at 1:45:17. So we're going to leave that going. I'm going to put it on mute. Okay, guys. So there we have it. That's the case. We are now on... Wait, why is this not working? We are now on jury watch. Callie, I just want to address your comments. It's very apparent that you are not a fan of Kevin Reddington. You are allowed to have your opinion. I don't think people are wanting to maybe debate right now about whether they like him or not. You're absolutely entitled to your opinion. A lot of us trust him. I think he's amazing. That's my opinion. Watching the testimony that Zizel and him got in together was masterful. Both old pros that know exactly what they were doing and how to do it. Agreed. Do we think that a longer deliberation is good or a bad sign for a guilty verdict? I think it's going to be a longer deliberation means that they're really like arguing and trying to figure it out, or debating and trying to figure out what the right thing is. And so it could just mean a hung jury. I think a longer deliberation, though, is probably better for the Commonwealth. I don't know. That's just my opinion. I'm not a lawyer. Okay, bye, Callie. Thanks for stopping by, I guess. I'm not sure. And did you just want to come in and try to stir shit up? I don't know. And I don't really care that he represents Jen McCabe. Somebody's gotta. You know? I know. Usually longer means good for the defense, but in this case, I don't know. Let me take a look at the poll results. Hold on. No, don't play ads in my ears. So right now we are 4% guilty. This is based on 316 votes. 4% guilty, 27% hung jury, 56% not guilty by reason of insanity, and 13% not guilty. I'm going to leave the poll up for a little bit, but that's where we're at right now. So most of you are thinking not guilty by reason of insanity. I'm very interested. I just assume there are going to be people on the jury who are going to be stuck in their opinions and will not be able to change them, whether it's for moral reasons, religious, you know, whatever it might be. It could be that they all agree on guilt, but in my brain for this case, if they all come back quickly, to me, it signifies they're all coming back because it's not guilty. But I don't know. I know I saw that. I think it was he with Dina? He sent a message to the glare that Will is his hero. I thought that was very sweet. I don't think he currently represents Jen McCabe. I don't know if he does or not. I know that he did represent her. I don't know if he still represents her. I do know that he has a good relationship with Aiden. He reached out to Aiden himself and said, hey, I misjudged you. I think the work that you're doing is amazing, and I wish we had you on the Lindsey Clancy case. So I don't know. Kevin, I reached out to him. I reached out to his office. Obviously, he's busy right now. But I did ask him to come on the show after the trial, so hopefully they'll get back to me. That would be amazing. I would love to just have a conversation with him for a couple of hours. That would be amazing. Right. Zealous advocacy is the thing, and they don't always have to believe their client. Right. So, all right. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stay on verdict watch. I'm sure you all are as well. I guess I don't expect a verdict today, but it's only 2:30. So court could be in session for the next 2.5-3 hours. So if they can get to it today, that'd be amazing. I don't know if they will. Her style isn't my style. It would make me anxious, but I think that is a me problem. The DA. So I'm going to be on verdict watch. I'm also going to hop over. I don't know if you guys know this right now, but it sounds like Rosemary Scapiccio is in the process of questioning Adam Lally in the Miles King case. So I'm going to bump over there and see if I can catch myself up on some of that, because Rebecca and I are coming back on in 2.5 hours at 5 p.m. to talk about these closing arguments, as well as Scapiccio v. Lally and Turtle Boy's motion to dismiss his criminal charges. So catch us back here. Give me a second. Take a deep breath, Mel. Don't forget to hit the notify me button on whatever device you plan to watch. I think that's how we figured out that it works. Although I'm sure it still has some weird hiccups. I really appreciate you all being with us this morning, being with me, and again this afternoon, and allowing me to yell at the camera. Oh God, Court TV is just showing exhibits, the photos of the Clancys with their kids. This is so sad. It's awful. Okay. I really appreciate you all. You've had so much respect in the chat, and we've been able to disagree. We've been able to debate things, which is what I always appreciate. I hope you'll keep coming back. Send me the cases that you're interested in covering via email. So somethingsoffpod@gmail.com. I don't know who's covering the Lally stuff. Probably Grant. Probably maybe the Trial Channel. I don't know. I'm going to have to go look for it. Maybe, you know, one of the local Boston channels. I really hope you guys come back at 5 and hang out with us for our regular show. And I will let you guys know what my plan is for tomorrow. I don't have any stream scheduled right now for tomorrow. So if we're still on verdict watch, I'll obviously just sort of be on call for that. So that's my plan right now. And yeah, y'all are great. Thank you so much for the super chats. Thanks for the memberships. Thank you so much for the Cluck Cash. The tips are supremely helpful, and I really appreciate it. If you feel inclined or are able to send over a tip, we really appreciate the tips, because YouTube doesn't take 30% from those tips. They come through Venmo, Cash App, or PayPal, which is listed at the top of the screen, also pinned in the chat, and there's a QR code on the screen for the Venmo. So I appreciate your tips. Please tip your server. Okay. Love you guys very much. Please take care of yourselves. Please hug your people and tell them you love them, and maybe go outside and put your face in the sun for a few minutes. And I will see you back here at 5 o'clock with Rebecca Louise Lavoy. Bye. You hear a verse in the break in the story. One little crack and the whole thing gets wary. A witness swears, but the timeline bends. A smile too smooth and the trail just ends. Mel Barrett says, hold up, look again. Rebecca Lavoy follows every thread. If it feels too neat, then it's not the truth. There's a shadow line running through the room. Something's off, something's off. You can feel it in the bones. Something's off, something's off.